Welcome to the 100th Monkey Radio Show, formerly known as Conscious TV. And we have a wonderful guest. Oh, forgot to introduce myself. With Tom and Ramon. And I'm Ramon, and Tom's on with me. And we have a wonderful guest today. But before we bring him in, let me just go over some quick things. Keep in mind that me and Tom do work, and this comes out of our pocket, so if you ever able to help us, please donate. We don't ask for much. And that'll help to pay for the people who can't, because we don't charge for our archives. It's all free, so you can go and listen to our first show. And also, let's see. We have... me and Tom do... have got more into doing healing and tarot. I do healing and Tom does tarot work, which I'm hearing a lot of great things about him on the internet. People are talking about you, Tom.
Oh, geez, look out. I'm having fun with it. I really enjoy doing it. Whenever I can do something, when I get the feedback of people going, wow, thank you, you know, that hits a spot in my heart that nothing else comes close to. So absolutely love doing it. So tonight we have somebody that is very well known in this area, in this field. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little portion of a foreword he wrote in a book called Confessions of an Intergalactic Anthropologist by his wife, Marcia Schaefer. Each of us is poised on the steps of a doorway into a frightening and infinite new reality. Our old world is over and an uncertain future awaits us all. This new age, this new paradigm, and a totally new form of life is evolving and is inevitable. We cannot run from it, we cannot hide from it, and we cannot try to avoid it because it is here and it is now. Where we are going will take courage and strength. I suspect many of us will not make the transition. Many of us will falter. Some of us are not ready, and all of us are a little bit of afraid of this unknown. So, Bob Dean, I read that. Actually, I was going through this book again this afternoon, and I read that, and I thought, well, you know, that pretty much puts it in a nutshell right there. That was an amazing foreword for Marcia's book. So,
yeah, that pretty much.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. So,
I would say that sums it up. That's actually probably one of the best ways I ever heard it put. What's going on right now with us?
So there's so many changes going on right now, Bob, that and what I'm seeing even in the UFO field from so many of the nuts and bolts guys are starting to put things together and realize that there's much more than just the nuts and bolts going on here. This goes into a spiritual aspect that is essential to truly understand what's going on.
Well, the nuts and bolts aspect of it is only about 5 or 10% of it at the most. From the very beginning, I've tried to make the point that this is predominantly a spiritual matter. The human race, the entire species, literally, is in a transition. We're going through what I call a transformative change. We're a transcendent transformation, actually, into a new species. The entire planet, the entire species, the human race, is undergoing this transition. And it's a difficult time. It's an awkward time. And the analogy I use, it's like children going through adolescence into adulthood.
Right.
So and, it's a difficult time, and the entire planet is involved. But essentially, it's not the UFO matter. It's not the nuts and bolts. I'm to a point anymore where I even dislike the term UFO. You know, it's so it's so unreal because they're not unidentified. We've known for years what they are.
Right.
But people have got to get beyond that and realize that we're not alone. We've never been alone. And the human species has had what I call it an intimate interrelationship with advanced extraterrestrial intelligence from the very beginning of our history. And that intimate interrelationship is still underway.
So why do you think it's been so covert through the ages?
Well, it's a matter of power and control. You know, the secret, the reality of their presence, the reality of our relationship with them, the truth, and the truth will come out eventually, is going to literally set us free. But the cover-up, the lie, it's a matter of power. It's a matter of control. And our so-called elite, our so-called powers that be, are scared to death to let this damn thing out, because when it really does all come out eventually, they're not going to be in charge anymore, and that scares the hell out of them.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. You can kind of see that their control is starting to slip through their fingers right now, and I kind of see that as their reactions are very evident in the world today. All the distractions and the wars and the fear that they're trying to throw out all over the place.
Especially with this last one. Oh, by the way, Bob, how did you enjoy the end of the world for you on the 21st?
I thought that was sad. That was pathetic, you know?
Yes, it was.
My heart goes out to those people. They're scared to death, and they don't really know their history, and they don't really know the reality of who they are and why they're here and what this is all about. And I find it like, you know, a bunch of little children. They're literally frightened to death, and I thought the whole thing was very, very sad.
Yeah, it's the fact that the guy has been collecting people's life savings and people just throwing money at him left and right. And I saw one guy that asked him a question here a couple of weeks ago. I asked him if on the 22nd, if all these people that had given him money on the 22nd, was he going to be returning it to him? And he didn't have much of a comment for that.
Well, that whole matter was inexcusable. You know, taking people's money, scaring the pants off of them. That was beyond. Was beyond excuse. That was sad.
Yeah. So let's get away from that. That's kind of ugly, whole ugly situation. I just don't really want to deal with it at all. So, now I heard in some of the interviews that I've heard of yours before that you actually are able to remember some of your past lives.
I went through a series of past life hypnotic regressions a number of years ago. And it was an experience that literally changed my life. I'd always had these nagging suspicions, these nagging feelings about other times and other places. And I wanted to find out what the hell it was all about, because, you know, I was attracted to certain parts of the world, and I was attracted to certain periods of time. And I had no reason for it. I couldn't figure it out. So I went through a series of regressions. And when it all was over, I was a changed person. I simply have not been the same since, because I found myself a very qualified hypnotist. And she put me through a series of regressions. I went through, I think, four separate sessions, and I came up with, I think, five separate lives one that we found on the last, it was so overwhelming to me that the emotion of it was so literally shocking and overwhelming that I had to stop the whole damn thing. I came up with a life in Galilee 2,000 years ago that I had never, ever dreamed of or expected. And let me tell you something about a hypnotic regression. When you get into the state where you get into a kind of a trauma state, and you don't just remember, you literally relive the emotion and the power, and it comes pouring up out of your subconscious. And it literally can be overwhelming. And I tell people who might be giving some thought to it, it's an interesting experience, but you have to be careful because it could open up some Pandora's boxes for you that you might not be prepared for.
Yeah, and, I found
a life in Galilee 2,000 years ago, and the emotional impact of that was so overwhelming that I had to call a screeching halt to the entire process. And it changed my life, literally.
So,
and over the years, I have found that I have been subjected to what I call spontaneous recollections. When you go through that process, and they literally, you know, open up your subconscious, you find that you are subject to what I call spontaneous recollections. And you know, watching a movie, listening to a piece of music, reading a book, looking at a piece of lovely scenery or something can trigger a remembrance of a past life. And as I said, when it starts coming up to you, it's not that you're simply remembering. You literally are reliving the events. And the emotional involvement can be pretty overpowering sometimes. So that did change me a lot, and I think it probably triggered the devotion and the dedication to what I've been doing now for the last 20 years.
So, prior to going through that, did you know in your heart? Did you know that reincarnation was a real phenomena?
Well, I had pretty well convinced of it most of my life, yeah. You see, I'm one of those weird characters, I guess. I have a vivid memory of being born.
Wow.
I used to tell my mother, you know, I remember being born, and she says, now, Bobby, no, you don't. You, I said, the hell I will remember, Mom. I was there, remember? And, anyhow, I remembered the birth experience. And all throughout my life, I've always had this reality, this realization that reincarnation was a real bit of truth. And never doubted it, actually. I think that's what triggered my insistence on having this series of past life regressions. Because I wanted to know a little bit about it. I wanted to know, you know, some of the background. Well, I literally, as I said, opened up Pandora's box, and I got more than I expected. And it changed my life, literally.
For the better, I would have to say.
Well, I think, yeah. You know, as my old friend Yeshua said in Galilee, the truth will set you free.
Now,
and it does indeed.
Are you comfortable with saying who you were in Galilee?
Well, apparently I was one of the guys that followed him around. I was the Greek. I was Philip, apparently. And the memories come pouring out, you know, the reality of it. I was a successful, fairly wealthy Greek businessman. And, you know, the truth, the stories that have been told by the church for the last 2,000 years are so far off off the reality of it. The church, as you probably know, if you've done your own homework, is a political institution. And the story of Christianity and the history of the Christian tradition and all is pretty much what the church wanted you to know. And it has very little to do with the reality of what really happened back then. And the evidence is pretty clear, but you got to dig for it. And I refer people to a scholar who just passed away this last year, Lawrence Gardner, Sir Lawrence Gardner, who was a writer and a researcher in the United Kingdom. And I got to know him before he died, and he was one of the greatest scholars of our time, and he knew the pretty much truth of the origins of Christianity. And he wrote about, I think I have in his collection, I think 8 books that he wrote before he died. And the history of Christianity is pretty clear. And Lawrence Gardner laid it out pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's not anything what the church will teach you, you know?
Right.
Mm. And that's why I have a lot of Christian friends. Some of them are fundamentalists. And once in a great while, we get into a discussion, and I remind them of a few facts and some realities that they often don't like to look at. But the truth is truth, and when you find it, it will indeed set you free.
Yep. Are you familiar with John Lamb Lash's work?
I know the name, but I'm not familiar with the work, no.
Yeah, he did a fantastic book on religion. The name of the book is Not in His Name, or Not in His Image. Yeah,
I've got that on my list. I don't have the book, but I'd like to get it.
Yeah, it's a very good read. Very good read. It does basically. Well, I think he actually quotes Gardner in there, if I'm not mistaken. But he has done some fantastic work there on the origins of Christianity, the Gnostics, and all that stuff. So.
Well, Yeshua was a Gnostic himself.
Absolutely.
And in the first century, the few people that they called the first Christians were basically Gnostic. And I've always had a weak spot in my heart for them.
Yeah.
Tom. I was going to ask you. What was Yeshua's training? Because there's always that part that I remember in Catholic school. I used to always ask between the age of 13 and 30. What was his training? Was he in India, as people say? Was he in Egypt?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about what I know and from what I remember and from my memories of actually being there. He was so much more than what the church would paint. He was probably one of the most educated men of the time. He spoke 6 languages fluently. He traveled extensively. He was born into a fairly wealthy family, and he had an uncle and a couple of cousins who were quite rich, literally. They worked with the Romans, and they had a trading company, and they went and they brought tin back from Cornwall. There, the Mediterranean world in that time, during the height of the Roman Empire, literally. Augustus was on the throne when Yeshua was born. And he was born into a family of wealth and power. And when he was growing up, he had the best education, and he traveled extensively all over the Mediterranean world. He went with his uncle on some of the expeditions over to Cornwall to bring tin back. And his uncle, the one that comes down in history as Joseph of Arimathea, literally was a very wealthy man and had a contract with the Romans to bring tin back from Cornwall. So Yeshua grew up in a wealthy family, went to school, traveled extensively, and had one of the finest educations. And as I said, he spoke six languages fluently. And the church has tried to put out the crap that, you know, he was born a simple carpenter and to a poor family and all, yakety yak, yak, yak. And that has nothing to do with the reality of it. The history is there, and Gardner wrote most of this in his books. This is not uncommon knowledge. This information is pretty well known to people who are scholarly and really do their homework. But you don't find too many scholars in the church, I'm sorry to say.
Well, that's all to tell the masses that it's okay to be poor and to suffer, and it's okay. That's Jesus did it, so you can do it too, and be happy.
Yeah. Keep... You know, one of the things that really ticked me off, as you guys know, I'm a retired military. I'm a retired command sergeant major, and I don't have a lot of patience with bullshit. And this garbage that the church puts out about him, never marrying, and good Lord, man, he was married and he had three children. And what is so interesting, the fact of the history is, he was legitimately born into a wealthy family. And by the very nature of his mother and his father, he was a legitimate claimant to the throne of Judea. And through his mother, he not only was claimant to the crown of Judea, he was claimant to the priesthood, the high priest. So he was the first man in about 1,000 years that had been born by the nature of his family, not only into the priesthood, the high priest, but to the throne. And good God, no wonder the Sanhedrin was so damn scared to death and had to get rid of him.
Yeah, that puts a whole new light on that, the sign they tacked over his head, the King of the Jews.
Oh, yeah, it puts a whole new light. The Romans knew exactly who he was. But the Romans were trying to keep the peace. The Romans were interested in only two things: collecting taxes and keeping the peace.
Right.
And if you paid your taxes and behaved yourself, the Romans didn't bother you that much. As a matter of fact, Yeshua had a lot of good Roman friends, for God's sake. He was well-educated, he traveled extensively, and he came from a wealthy family. And he moved in political circles, and the Romans rather liked him. There were a lot of Romans who used to come and visit with him all the time, because they recognized him, and he was a tremendous scholar. And as I said, he spoke six languages fluently, and... You don't get any of this garbage from the church. I mean, you don't get the truth from the church. All you do is get garbage.
Yeah.
So a lot of my Christian friends, you know, they've kind of written me off a long time ago.
Tell me about it.
I'm a bit of an embarrassment to them, I'm afraid. Anyhow, I'm a student of history, guys. One of my majors in college years ago, when I was going through Indiana University as a boy, I had two majors. I majored in psychology and I majored in ancient history. So I love ancient history, and I think, you know, it's the fact that I had a nagging, suspicious memory of previous lives, which is why I have been particularly attracted to ancient history. Particularly the ancient history of the Mediterranean world.
Now, was that your first and only life there that you remember, or you had several in that region?
Oh, God. One of the first ones we came up with, I was a high priest in Ur. Probably about, 3000 B.C.
Where's Ur?
Well, it's an ancient city in Sumer.
Yep. Sumerian.
Along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers there in modern Iraq, it was a country that was known as Sumer in the ancient world. And the Sumerians actually was the first Western civilization. And they were established literally by the Anunnaki. And I use that term in a generic sense.
Right.
You know, the Anunnaki is literally in a Sumerian word meaning those who came down from above. And it's all laid out pretty thoroughly in Zechariah Sitchin's work.
Yeah.
But ancient Sumer literally was the world's first major Western civilization. It was established primarily by the Anunnaki, who landed and built cities and developed a civilization there. And they literally genetically manipulated the human genome. But you got to get into Zechariah's work to really get into that. Are you familiar with Sitchin?
Oh, yeah. I've got all his books.
I miss the old man. I got to know him fairly well before he died.
Yeah, well, he did some. He left his mark on the world, for sure.
Oh, he did indeed.
I'm sure he's either back or will be back soon.
Well, you know, we all come and go. It's like the Grand Central Station, if you don't mind the pun, you know. You know, literally, it's heavy traffic, guys. We come and go all the time. Coming into this world and incarnating on planet Earth is considered to be in the world on the other side one of the roughest and most difficult educations that you can go through. But if you can come and go through several lives on planet Earth, man, you're looked upon with high regard because, you know, planet Earth is one of the most difficult schools in the galaxy. And that's true. I mean, all you got to do is live on this damn planet for a few years, and you know what I'm talking about.
I will have to agree with that one, yes.
So this is the planet of hard knocks? Hard knocks?
Well, it's not only hard knocks. It's a planet of bloodshed and misery and heartbreak. Yeah. It literally is considered to be by the spiritual intelligences from the other side. It literally is considered to be one of the roughest schools in the galaxy. When you come here and you go through several lives here, you're highly regarded. You know, I jokingly say they give you certificates for matriculating here on planet Earth. Hmm. So when you incarnate, you do it voluntarily. Nobody grabs you and throws you screaming into this cauldron down here. Spiritually, you make a choice. You come because you want to come. You come because you want to learn. You come because you want to grow and evolve and develop. And you come and you go through pure hell down here sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember any of your incarnations in another planet, or this is the only one you remember?
Well, no, I've been on other planets. I've lived lives on other planets, but the last ones that I were able to come up with here were on this planet. And as I said, I was a priest in Ur, the ancient city of Ur in Mesopotamia. I was an Etruscan scholar and priest, 600 B.C. In north central Italy. I was a Templar knight in the Middle East in the 12th century. And, Lord, what else did I have? Well, several, but that one in Judea, that one in Galilee, that's the one that just literally emotionally tore me apart.
Yeah.
Because as I said, you don't just remember those events, you literally relive them. And the emotional impact of it can actually be overwhelming.
Yeah. So, Bob, I'm going to segue off into a little different area here. We're going into an area of the galaxy, of the universe right now. It seems like we are being bombarded with cosmic radiation and cosmic waves and magnetic waves and whatever you want to call them that are tangibly and practically visibly changing the consciousness of mankind right now. What's your take on what's going on? What's really happening?
Well, from what I've learned over the years, we literally are completing what the ancients used to refer to as the Great Year. The ancients considered that there was a 26,000 year cycle. Actually, 25,920. What it is 12 times 2,160 years. As you guys probably know, one of the astrological ages, and there are 12 of them in our current astrological calendar, each age is 2,160 years. And 12 times 2,160 comes out to about 25,920. Well, we are completing a great year, that full 26,000-year cycle. We are ending up completing the 12th sign of the zodiac, the sign of Pisces, the one that I was born under. And we are literally reaching the end of the age of Pisces. And we're going to start a new astrological count. And that 26,000 year period involves our movement through the galaxy. And we're coming up to a period of time here where we're picking up incredible amounts of radiation from the center of the galaxy. And what it is doing, it is literally changing genetically the genome of the human species. And what it is doing, it is triggering genes that have been considered to be for some time. You probably heard the term junk genes.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, they've done research and they've been, mapping the genome of the human species. And they came up with a bunch of genes that they didn't have any reason why they even existed. So they called them junk genes. Well, bullshit. They weren't junk genes. They're genes that have not been activated yet. Well, we are now in a process of moving through that edge part of the galaxy where that radiation we're getting from the center of the galaxy is going to activate those genes. And it's going to be turning the human race into a new species. And that's why it's so painful. That's why it's so awkward. That's why I call it, coming out of adolescence. And it's difficult times, guys. But look around the world, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Look what's happening with weather. The whole planet is going through a change, not just the fauna, not only the flora and the fauna, but the entire planet is undergoing change. And when this is all over with, in another year, another century, we're going to be a new species.
Now,
and we're going to be going out into the stars, and we're going to be claiming our rightful place out there with our cousins. And it's going to be a new world and a new race. And a new beginning.
For yourself, Bob, do you feel any physical changes that you can definitely say, okay, I definitely feel that I'm changing physically from whatever is happening?
Oh, I've been going through so damn many changes in the last 30 years. Hell, I'm 82, guys.
Just...
the old carcass is beginning to fall apart on me.
You still got, what, another 50 years, right?
Oh, well, you know, genetically, if I were to take better care of myself, I'd probably last another 100 years. But I, you know, I've been living a fairly good life over the years. I'm an omnivorer. I like good steaks. I drink good bourbon, and I smoke good cigars. And when I was younger, I used to chase the ladies. Now, if I chased the lady and caught her, I wouldn't know what to do with her. But, yeah, I've been going through some changes, and my relationship with my cousins and my good friends out there. If you guys have been watching some of the interviews I've been giving Kerry Cassidy, the last couple of interviews, I laid out some pretty blunt stuff. I've had a personal relationship with non-human intelligence since I was 2.5 years old.
I've been
aboard their ship. I've met them. I've talked to them. They take me aboard from time to time. They took me with them one time for 6 weeks, for Christ's sake.
And, yeah, that would have been quite an experience, and then come back 5 minutes after you left. Wow.
Well, you you must have seen the interview. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
That shook the hell out of me, to be honest with you guys. I told Kerry I went through three stages. I thought, I think I'm beginning to lose my mind. And then the second stage was I was convinced I had lost my mind. And I'm now in stage three, guys. I'm sane and the rest of the world is nuts.
There you go.
So I'm in stage three and I'm enjoying it. And I've went through all kinds of changes, you know.
So stage four is when the rest of the world wakes up and says, wow, that guy isn't crazy.
Well, stage four is when the people begin to start paying attention. And they realize that people like me are not just, you know, speaking out of the side of their mouth.
Right.
There are people like me who are telling them the truth if they just shut up and pay attention. And I've been prodding, you know, you'd be surprised. I'll be telling you both of you. You would be surprised at the number of top military people, intelligence people, politicians, not only in the United States, but all over the planet, that have had personal relationships with non-human intelligence, but they've never had the courage to come out and speak out about it. Now, I promise, I kind of predict in the next year or two, hopefully, that you're going to find out a lot of people in high positions of politics and in the military will get the courage to speak out, come forward, and come out of the closet, as it were, as I did, and say, look, Dean is not just an old fool. He's telling you the truth, so pay attention, because it happened to me, too. You know, my good friend over in Santa Fe, Neil Freer, wrote a white paper a couple of years ago where he laid it out pretty thoroughly that he'd had a relationship with non-human intelligence since he was 7 years old. So Neil went public with it, and I thought, well, I have a tremendous regard for him. So that's when I began to come out, and a year ago in Laughlin, I gave Kerry that interview. And in the last interview, the fourth interview, which is just last February here in Phoenix, I laid it all out pretty clearly, pretty bluntly, as you remember.
Yeah.
But other people will do this, I think, in time. I think you're going to find a few politicians. It's already happening in Europe. I think a couple of politicians in Georgia, what used to be the old Soviet Union, a couple of other places, have come out and said that they've had a personal relationship and they've met some of the guys from out there.
Actually, the ex-prime minister,
his wife, right? Yeah.
His wife was talking about how she was in contact with them,
and they were just making fun of
Japan's ex prime minister's wife, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I read something about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you're going to see more. You're going to see more and more of that, guys. And I think people like me and Neil Freer, you know, we're coming out, opening the door, as it were, and making it possible and acceptable for other people to step forward.
Right, right.
If I had said some of these things 30, 40 years ago, when I was in the military, or when I was working for FEMA, well, good God, I would have lost my job, and they probably would have put me in a mental institution.
Right.
But now I can get away with it, and now I'm having, frankly, a good time. You know, I'm being honest and candid and open, and I'm telling the facts, I'm telling the truth, and I rather enjoy it.
It's kind of refreshing to be able to open up and speak what's on your mind instead of have to walk around on eggshells with people and, you know, I can't talk about that because they'll all poo-poo me and...
Yeah, I know. Well, it's like the old religious concept, you know, confession is good for the soul.
Yep. It definitely
feels really is. It really is. It really is. No pun intended.
Bob, can we go a little bit into the beginning of the story when you were, I believe it was 2 or 3 years old? The experience you had?
Yeah, well, I laid that out with Carrie during the third interview up in Laughlin over a year ago. And when I was a little tyke, I was an only child, and I was a Pisces, and I loved being near the water. And my dad was a railroader, and back when I was a little tyke, as you know, I was born in 1929, grew up during the Depression. I was living in Covington, Kentucky, and we had a little house just down the street, about a block away from a large industrial canal. And this canal had been dredged to carry ore barges and slag from a foundry. And I used to go down there, just a little tight, go down in my little jumper play suit, and go down and I'd throw pieces of wood into the canal. And then I would throw pebbles at the pieces of wood. And one day I tumbled into the canal, 40 feet down, steep sides, into the water, and I was by myself. And I proceeded to start drowning, literally. I was splashing around down there, grasping, trying to get a hold on the side of the dredged canal, and it was just kind of slippery and muddy, and I couldn't get a hold of it, and I was just a tyke, just 2 and a half, close maybe to 3 years old. And I remember vividly the incident as it was transpiring, because I literally thought in my little 2 and a half, 3-year-old mind, that this had been a short trip. And here I was, you know, splashing around, and the side of the canal was getting smeared, muddy, slippery. I couldn't get a hold of it, and it was rather steep. And I was getting ready to drown, literally. And about that time, a powerful pair of hands grasped me from behind and lifted me up 40 feet out of that industrial canal and put me up on the side of the canal at the top, 40 feet up, on the edge where I had tumbled from. And I vividly remember, it was like yesterday. I looked behind me, you know, there was nobody there. I was alone. But I had this feeling, this vivid feeling of two large, powerful hands grasping me under my arms and lifting me up, smeared with mud, out of this canal and putting me up 40 feet on the edge. And I looked around, and of course there was nobody there. And in my little child's mind, I thought, oh boy. But then I was overwhelmed by the reality of the deep doo-doo that I was going to be in, because my mother was going to see my little play suit all smeared with mud and I'm soaking wet. And she's going to know that I violated her rules and I went down there when I shouldn't have. And the fear of punishment overwhelmed me, and I toddled back home, and I got just exactly what I expected. And I didn't really think about the event itself until later. Until now, much later. And
that's what I was going to ask Carrie, you.
During the interview, I told Carrie, I said, you know, when I was in the military and my life was saved in Korea, oh, I guess 4 or 5 times. My life was saved in Vietnam 3 or 4 times. I was in situations where I should have died and I didn't. And guys, I began to remember and I began to put 2 and 2 together and it began to dawn on me that I have been looked after and protected for most of my life. And it's like, you know, you go on about your life and you hesitate to take some of these bits and pieces and put them together. But in the last 20 years, I've been doing a lot of that. And I've been putting it all together, and it's turned out to be a picture that I can't avoid anymore. I've been looked after. I've been protected. I've been taken care of. My life was saved in Korea and Vietnam time and time and time again. And after I went through that hypnotic past life regression, some more of the bits and pieces began to come together. And it dawned on me that I've come with a purpose, I have a meaning, and I'm here to do a few things before I leave. And that's what I've been doing now for the last 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I feel comfortable about it. I really do feel that I'm making a bit of a difference. As I told Carrie on that last interview here just in February, for the first time, it's been clear to me that why I came. And I'm going to be here at least for another couple of years, I think. Because I'm not finished yet.
Yeah. If I see a lot of people that there's a kind of a fuzzy line between UFO and angelic intervention. What a lot of people are say back in 2,000 years ago, all this intervention of any kind would have been called angelic. Angels came and saved me instead of our cosmic brothers or UFOs or whatever, however people want to term it. They would have labeled them as a supernatural being versus our cosmic neighbors.
Well, looking back 2,000 years, our ancient ancestors looked upon these guys as gods, literally.
Right.
They deified them. You know, every major religion on the planet has its origin with advanced extraterrestrial intervention. And I've said this repeatedly, and some of my fundamentalist friends take me to task for it, but every major religion on this planet was initiated and orchestrated by advanced extraterrestrial intelligence. And yes, our ancestors looked upon them as gods or angels, you know, and because of the technology that they demonstrated repeatedly, that since our ancestors couldn't grasp and couldn't understand, They called them gods or angels. But we're having a relationship with the same entities, the same creatures, the same cousins of ours today, and they're not angels and they're not gods. They're advanced intelligences from other places.
Right.
Now, I will tell you guys that there are advanced intelligences out there that literally, in our concept, would be considered to be angelic. I mean, the top of the hierarchy is spiritual. There is an incredible hierarchy of power and intelligence in the universe. And at the very highest level of it, they are predominantly spiritual. And I guess it's not improper to consider them literally angelic.
Right.
But that's a long way from God. Now, there is a God. There is an ultimate source. That there is a cause. There is a beginning. There is a conscious intelligence, literally, that permeates the universe. And this conscious intelligence is benign, loving, caring, creative, and predominantly loving. But that is God. That is what I consider to be God. But there are a lot of advanced intelligences below that level that we might consider angelic, and with the very nature of their technology that, you know, we might consider them to be godlike. One of the interesting things I have learned that some of them literally damn near appear to be halfway, practically immortal. They genetically manipulated their own genome to the point that literally they don't die. Now, you look at those guys.
Yeah.
You can understand why our ancestors would think of them as either angels or gods.
That brings me to one particular person or being in particular from the old Bible, Mr. Jehovah, who I feel
well, Jehovah, that's
so,
another
so
piece
much
of history.
Damage.
Well, Jehovah is another piece of history that's been screwed up completely. Yahweh, which is where the word Jehovah comes from, was not a name initially. It was a title. It was an Anunnaki title for one of their lords. And there were several Yahwehs. There were a couple of them that were pretty decent guys. And there was a Yahweh or two that were not so damn decent. There was one Yahweh, for God's sake, that literally I would consider to be a psychopath.
That's
so,
what I was thinking.
You know, most of the Jewish tradition that developed into the Christian tradition have got this character they call Yahweh or Jehovah, and that's not a name at all, it's a title. And there were several Yahwehs, but most Christians have not, they're not very scholarly, and they haven't done their homework. But there are so damn many things to be unlearned, guys.
Yeah.
Before we start addressing the truth, as difficult as it's going to be, we're going to have to get rid of all the bullshit and so all of the crap that has been heaped upon us over the centuries by the politicians in the church who were interested in power for themselves.
Right.
I think in the 3rd century, the 4th century, well, with Constantine, it became politically primarily. And it's gone downhill ever since.
Right. Council of Nicaea.
So, Tom, we're coming up upon the hour. We're going to take a...
Yeah, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back into the archives and talk some more with Bob. So, Bob, I know you've got what's your tour look like this summer? You're speaking at a few places.
Well, I accepted the invitation from James to come up at the end of June. I don't still have a permanent date on it yet. I guess, you know, somewhere in the last week of June, I'll be going up there.
It's the 24th, 25th, and 26th, I think, are the actual dates.
Okay, good.
24th through the 27th are the actual dates. 24th is a Friday, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, most people are getting there probably Thursday. Me and Tom will be there the 22nd.
And yeah.
We'll be there till the 29th. Helping James out.
Well, good. I'll be looking forward to seeing you guys up there.
Yeah.
I've got a speaking engagement in California. Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan are putting on their second conference program out there.
Oh, nice. I'm glad to see they're working together.
September. I don't know the dates, but it's toward the end of September, I think.
Cool.
And then I've accepted an invitation to speak at a big MUFON conference in Philadelphia in October. And then I was recently invited by Michael Kellinger to come and speak in South Africa in November.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. We just had him on the show last week.
Well, Kellinger is a brilliant man. He is a hell of a nice guy. I like him. I like him a lot. And he invited me to a big conference in South Africa in November.
Well, that'll be a fun trip.
Well, it will be. It's a long trip, but I told him if he can come up with a business class ticket for me, I'll be there.
There you go.
But after my awkward experience coming back from Barcelona 2 years ago, I won't travel cabin class anymore. I just can't do it, guys. My age and, you know, I have a couple of medical problems. And just to put it bluntly, I can't stand in line to pee anymore. So, you know, if you can't get me a business class ticket, I'm afraid I'll have to turn you down.
But we'll I don't blame you. I've flown those long hours in coach.
Oh, listen.
No matter what kind of condition you're in, it's hard.
I've been to Australia a couple of times, and I went down to Brazil once. And, you know, I was in Japan several years ago, and those long flights, man, when I was younger, I could do it. But I really can't do that anymore, and it's not that I've become snobbish. I simply cannot put up with... the limitations of standing in line, for God's sake.
Yep.
My mother feels the same way. She won't come visit us unless we can get her a business class ticket. So,
I understand that.
All right.
So, okay. Well, join us over in the archive section, guys. Let's see. Condemnation Without Investigation, The Height of Ignorance, the100thmonkeyradio.com.
And that is... the 100monkeyradio.com.
Okay. All right, we'll see you in the archives.